from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. This is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Brian Ballow, and I'm here with my buddies, Peter Onuf.
Hey, Brian.
And Ed Ayers.
Hey, Brian.
In 1989, Karen von Langen was working as an architect in New York City. That November, she was immersed in the final phase of a competition to design a public building in West Berlin.
I was in my office working, and someone had a radio on, and the news came across the radio that the border at the Brandenburg Gate had been opened. It was a huge shock. I was so surprised that we went and found a television.
At this moment, we are taking you live to the Brandenburg Gate and the Berlin Wall.
Brandenburg Gate, of course, is in East Berlin, and the sound that you hear and what you're seeing tonight, not hammers and sickles, but hammers and chisels as young people take down this wall.
This is really a scene of happiness. The wall is still standing, as you see, but the wall is political rubble, because today, the government of East Germany announced that its borders are open.
That announcement, it turns out, was a bit premature. Earlier that day, East Germany's leaders had decided they would soon ease travel restrictions between East and West. They wanted to stop street protests, and they also wanted to slow down an exodus of East Germans to the West through Hungary. But the spokesman tasked with announcing this news hadn't been fully briefed, and he mistakenly told reporters that the changes would take effect immediately. Within hours, thousands of East Germans were swarming the wall's checkpoints. No longer ordered to use force against the people, the guards had little choice but to let them through.
1 week later, Karen von Langen was living in a loft apartment next to the western side of the wall. Five floors up, she could look out across the no man's land on the eastern side that had for almost 30 years separated the two sides of Berlin.
And my very particular memory of that period is at night, listening to people chipping away at the wall. It's a tick, 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 tick. So you end up 2 or 3 days later finding these small holes all over in the wall.
There was nothing inevitable about this remarkable chain of events. It came as a complete surprise to people on both sides of the Iron Curtain. Earlier that year, the East German leader, in fact, had predicted the wall would stand for another 50 years at least, maybe 100. And so when the wall did fall, Berliners were absolutely ecstatic, as well as surprised. For weeks, all-night parties raged in the streets.
But at the same time, it was becoming clear that the profound social and economic divisions between East and West were not going to fall away with the wall. Karen tells one story about the cars that East Germans were accustomed to driving.
There were these small German cars that were called Trabis, and they were very, very simple cars. And if you saved up your money and you had a slightly better job, then you could get a car, and it was a very prestigious thing to have a car.
And then came November of 1989.
And suddenly, they drive to the West and see these super-duper Mercedes, and they feel ridiculous in these small little two-button cars. You turn it on, you turn it off, there's a windshield wiper. And so each month that I went, I'd hear another car story or another story like this where people were trying to adjust to becoming someone else, something else.
Today, Berlin really is a unified city. You'd be hard-pressed to find anything but small differences between East and West. But reunification was a process, one that took its toll on both sides. Westerners were shocked to discover the level of deprivation that their fellow Berliners had faced for years. Easterners, for their part, were also disoriented. They found themselves in a city that was both familiar and foreign.
There was a lost generation in there of young people who were coming of age in the East, had grown up in the Eastern system of education and training for jobs that would not be there anymore. And some of them make it, and some of them are able to adapt, but a lot of people were not, and it was very hard on them, very, very hard.
conflicts like the Cold War, conflicts that span generations, they can take on kind of a lifeless quality in the history textbooks. But in the immediate shadow of these conflicts, life has gone on. Children have grown up, shaped at least to some extent by the narratives of conflict that surround them. And so what happens when those conflicts end? How do people learn to live alongside their former enemies and, in a sense, to live alongside their former selves?
These are questions we'll be considering for the rest of the hour today. We're marking the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall with a show about reconciliation and its limits through an American perspective. We'll consider the difficult process of reconstructing the South after the Civil War and consider the relationship between Reconstruction and reconciliation. We'll hear about a detente between two New York City gangs and about what that truce enabled. And we'll discuss reconciliation with a person who survived the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and still remembers every moment of that terrible day.
But first, a story about reconciliation in the wake of the American Revolution. Now, this is not a story about Yankee patriots and British redcoats, but rather about Americans who sided with the Revolution and other Americans who sided with the enemy. Those British sympathizers were known as Loyalists and amounted to as much as one-fifth of the population. In many senses, the war for independence was a civil war, with neighbors taking up arms against neighbors. And nowhere was the brutality more pronounced than in the South, where militiamen on both sides roamed the backcountry looking to settle personal scores in a virtually lawless environment. In many cases, these men were acting more out of camaraderie with their local leaders than out of any deep ideological commitments. But still, the violence was real. Homesteads were destroyed, women were attacked, and prisoners of war were murdered, all without a redcoat in sight. And so you might expect that when the war ended in 1782, retribution for atrocities committed by Loyalists would be swiftly meted out by the Patriot victors. But this was not the case. Historian Rebecca Brannan has written about the reintegration of Loyalists in South Carolina. She told me what that state's leaders did with the men who had taken up arms against them.
For 200 and some unlucky men, they confiscated all their property, and they banished them forever from the state. They withdrew their citizenship.
Oh, that sounds pretty severe, yeah.
That's pretty severe. And for another 62, I believe the number is, those 62 have to pay a one-time levy or tax on the entire value of their estate, and it ranges between about 12 and 25%, depending on how punitive the legislature wanted to be.
Well, this is legislation that pretends to be punitive but actually offers terms. Let's talk. Let's negotiate.
And then most of the people named on those lists petition, and those petitions are usually successful. The few who don't manage to get away from this punitive legislation, it's usually because there's very specific damaging information about things they did, like one cooper who deliberately made bad barrels so the meat to defend Charleston from the British would go bad, and then
Whoa.
He bragged about it.
Foolish man.
Foolish man, yes.
You know, this legislation really only sounds punitive in retrospect. Everybody in 1784 agreed that had it been applied, it would have been punitive for the few people to whom it applied.
Right.
It doesn't sound like a nasty and vicious and vengeance-driven reconstruction.
And then in the next 2 years, the Loyalists themselves really decide to make a case for reintegration, and they apologize. Even if they're not very good at it, even if they find it painful, they apologize to their neighbors.
Tell us about these apologies. It sounds extraordinary. I'm sorry that we pillaged your plantation and killed various relatives.
To be fair, they don't usually admit to anything criminal in their apologies.
So they don't really apologize, do they?
Some of them don't really apologize.
Yeah.
You get these occasional letters.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll get 50 neighbors who will sign a petition to the legislature saying, this former loyalist, he's a good guy. He's made up with us. We think he's a really good, dependable neighbor. And 50 of us are willing to sign our name to this.
Rebecca, why would 50 neighbors who identify with the revolution be willing to forgive some jerk who pillages the neighborhood and kills people? Explain it.
At its heart, they decide that a A society that's obsessed with punishing people is a society that's not what they want.
Rebecca, let's step back now and see if we can get the moral of the story. And what happened after 1782 very quickly is that neighborhoods, in effect, forgave the transgressors. The winners declared a peace, and those people who had been identified as neighbors were forgiven. What do you draw from that?
That a sense of neighborliness and a sort of citizenship as lived obligation to other people mm-hmm. that you have to demonstrate over time has been part of the United States a long time, that it's part of the vision for every great word the Founding Fathers spoke about individual rights.
Mm-hmm.
They also had in mind the individual obligation to the whole.
Right.
That's what loyalists were able to use to convince the victorious patriots to let them back in.
Yeah.
And that it has staying power.
Right. So it's the forgiveness, which you've suggested is kind of a model for reconciliation. But could it also be argued that it's a sense that the entire community had fallen apart, that there was no order, and there was a desperate need for order? Is that the same thing as reconciliation, or is that everybody has, in effect, a bad war in South Carolina? The sooner you put it behind, the better.
I certainly think there are moments where they are all haunted by the realization of just how thin the veneer of civilization can be.
Right, right.
I certainly think that they worked very hard to excise any mention of the loyalists and any mention, therefore, of disunity in the revolution. And they do it by not talking about it. It's not talked about in public. And it's remarkable when they choose the battles to commemorate, they don't necessarily choose the battles that were most militarily interesting or were the hardest to win. They choose the ones that seem to emphasize unity.
Right.
And this works because then the next generation and the generation after it sort of have forgotten that there were loyalists.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally the descendants of loyalists are themselves aware of this fact. But it's not clear the people they interact with every day are or think about it.
Invoking that contemporary idea of truth and reconciliation, the modeled in South Africa, in South Carolina, you have reconciliation without truth.
Yes, absolutely. And it appeared to work really well.
Right, until it didn't.
Until it didn't. I do think there's a way in which, and I should emphasize, this is white South Carolinians.
Yes, of
course. For those black people who chose the British cause, they had to leave.
Mm-hmm.
But for white South Carolinians, they do a really, really good job of, as you say, forgetting the truth while they're at it.
Right.
So much so that they actually use the American Revolution and the legacy of the American Revolution to talk themselves into the American Civil War. Obviously, there's other reasons for the American Civil War, but when you read what they wrote, they always see themselves as preserving the true legacy of the American Revolution, that they're all the patriots now. And it's hard for me not to find sort of chilling echoes of the way that they'd managed to forget what happens when you rip the top off Pandora's box.
So you sound deeply conflicted to me and ambivalent about your subject, and that is, on the one hand, you admire the speed with which apologies, forgiveness, reconciliation healed, or at least put a big bandage over the wounds of war in South Carolina. But then you say down the line there may be a price you pay for that kind of speedy reconciliation.
I think I am, because I think that they lost the chastening voice that reminded them why you don't court civil war.
Rebecca Brannon is a history professor at James Madison University. Her book, due out soon, is Burying the Hatchet in South Carolina, Healing the Wounds of Revolutionary Civil War. Earlier in the segment, we heard from Karen Van Lengen. She's a professor of architecture here at the University of Virginia.
You're listening to Backstory. I'm Brian Bellow.
I'm Mitt Ayers.
And I'm Peter Onuf. Today on the show, stories about reconciliation and its limits in the wake of war.
Peter, Ed, we're talking about reconciliation and, of course, the big enchilada of reconciliation is Reconstruction after the Civil War.
Right.
But frankly, being a 20th century guy, I think about what happened after World War II. America's mortal enemies seem reconciled with the American economy, an American way of life, buying Coca-Cola,
sure.
and really, most importantly, American military protection. I mean, Germany becomes a key part of our alliance in Europe, and we depend on Japan as an ally in East Asia. And what really strikes me about all of that, in contrast to the Civil War,
yeah.
is it happens seemingly overnight.
Yeah,
I mean, it's quick.
Right.
And then in Germany, in 1989, the wall comes down. Oh, my God, what are we going to do with these two different systems, East Germany, West Germany? Well, within a few years, really, they are relatively united as one country. That just seems so different
than
the Civil War.
My only problem with this is that's not reconciliation. That's capitulation. That is, the reconciliation
something
is
something you would never do,
no,
Peter.
It's on American terms. You're not reconciling with the people who made war against you. You've purged Germany of the Nazis. And, of course, the Nazis' pervasive power throughout German life means that this is a wrenching, profound change. That's not what you have in America after the American Civil War.
So, Peter, you're saying that the problem in America is we were dealing with the same darn people as before.
And we said it's okay to be the same darn people because we had this myth of national wholeness. We are one people. Well, in these wars you're talking about, our good war, World War II, and the war against communist oppression, well, we don't think that we're reconciling with those systems. We've destroyed them.
And you're exactly right. In the South, we have reconciliation because it is literally the same people who were on the battlefields fighting against the Northern soldiers who are running everything in the South after the war. Now, here's the interesting twist, of course. The North thinks that it is reconstructing the South in what is called,
that,
of course,
we?
Reconstruction, right? And what we actually call reconstruction is to do something not unlike what happened after World War II and even after 1989, Brian, rewrite the constitutions so that it's not the same people, right, Peter?
Yeah.
That you have the people
well,
who were enslaved, right? Enslaved men are now enfranchised voters. You see that nowhere else in the modern world. And so our reconstruction had the capacity to be one of the great reconstructions, the most thoroughgoing in world history, but it fails by the end of Reconstruction. That is rendered moot. They are not able to vote. Mm-hmm. The Constitution says they can, but by basically terrorism on the ground, black men are not able to
and
vote.
And Ed, doesn't that underscore Peter's point that, in fact, we literally end up with the same people or end up excluding the same people now by disenfranchisement rather than slavery?
Yes, and compared to the remarkably rapid transformation you're talking about, Brian, this takes decades to unfold. It's not until around 1900 that the South actually comes up with ways in its constitutions to say, hey, yeah, we know we can't preclude black men from voting, but hey, you have to have literacy, have to pay a poll tax. And so, Brian, it's painfully long in the South, and it's never really reconstructed. The South has slavery knocked out from underneath it. Black people are giving nothing to rebuild new lives. The Southern economy is given no support, and the South suffers in poverty for generations.
So, Ed, what is reconciled, at least on the surface, between North and South?
They would have said, hey, what are you talking about? Brian, Peter, we're reconciled.
Sure.
Look at all these monuments. We get together for reunions. We shake hands. You know, the soldiers on both sides are perfectly reconciled. Hey, good fight, guys.
Yeah, yeah.
You fought really well. We fought really well. And you fought for what you thought was right. It turned out to be wrong. But hey, you know, what are you going to do?
And we can all embrace this one great nation myth. We are a people. And that comes into clear focus when we go out across the world to make war. When there are enemies out there who are un-Americans. So there is a bond of national solidarity that's based on sustaining the fiction that we became a great people in 1776, and we've been charging forward ever since. The Civil War was unfortunate. I'm all with you, Ed. I think you needed a genuine transformation of Southern society if you were going to achieve the promises of the Declaration of Independence and of those of the Emancipation Proclamation and the new constitutions.
And the equivalent of the wall falling, Brian, are the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and 65. And now we are just seeing, again, in slow motion, the same kind of social transformation
right.
that began with World War II and the Marshall Plan and then later the fall of the Berlin Wall. You're just now having the South being rebuilt on an inclusive basis. Something I've said is Martin Luther King did more for the economic development of the South mm-hmm. than anybody else ever did, by removing the burden of the equivalent of the Berlin Wall, which was segregation from the South. It now has all these German and Japanese car companies are now setting up shop in the South. Right?
But I'm going to push back a little, Ed.
All right.
Because I would argue the rebuilding and true reconstruction of the South starts with World War II, when all of these federal defense plants begin going into the South, mm-hmm. and the North uses that as a lever to begin demanding, slow as it was, the kinds of changes that are going to lead to the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act.
So I'm going to push back on you pushing back on me, because you are exactly right. The economic history of the South is transformed by World War II and that massive defense spending. But it's Black Southerners themselves who take the opening provided by that. You know, the North never brings integration to the South.
We are agreed.
That is something that Black Southerners themselves do.
We are agreed on that.
And it seems to me the sequence is important here. There's a kind of reconciliation that, as human beings, respective of the rights of all peoples, we see taking place now, in the wake of a belated transformation or reconstruction of Southern society.
I think that's great, Peter. And the reconciliation we see today is that the South is the main magnet for Black in-migration. You know that some kind of reconciliation has taken place when Black Americans say, you know, I'm going back South. It is now our home again.
In 1911, a Native American walked out of the wilderness near Oroville, California. He didn't speak English, he wore few clothes, and he didn't know much about the westernized modern world. He was the last survivor of the Yahi tribe.
Local authorities handed him over to a group of anthropologists at UC Berkeley. They called him Ishi and housed him in, of all places, a San Francisco museum. That's where Ishi lived as both a janitor and, well, a kind of living exhibit, showing throngs of visitors how to make arrowheads. He was a sensation. He was known as America's last Stone Age Indian. But just 5 years later, Ishi died from tuberculosis. His body was cremated and placed in an urn in a San Francisco cemetery.
And that's where our next episode of Reconciliation begins. It picks up almost a century later in the late 1990s. It was then that a group of Native Americans banded together to give Ishi a proper burial in his ancestral homeland. Anthropologist Oren Starn, who was writing a book about Ishi, traveled to Oroville to meet with the Maidu tribe and heard something intriguing.
One of the men there told me that he had heard a rumor that Ishi's brain had been removed from his body. In other words, that when Ishi was cremated, his brain wasn't part of the human remains that were put in that jar in that cemetery. And he said that he had heard a rumor that Ishi's brain had been pickled, preserved for science, that it was on a museum or hospital shelf somewhere. He didn't know where.
So Starn decided to do a little digging. If the brain was really out there somewhere, he wanted to find it. After going through some old correspondence between anthropologists, he discovered the rumor was true.
Yep. Strange as it might seem, science in the late 19th century was in the throes of a brain craze. Scientists preserved brains and used them as evidence for their ideas about racial hierarchies. By 1916, the brain fad was on its way out. But it hadn't disappeared altogether, which helps explain why Ishi's brain was taken from his body. Taken, says Starn, despite the fact that the idea would have horrified Ishi himself.
In Native Californian culture, and in particularly in Yahi culture, there was a quite strong idea that the dead should be handled as little as possible, that once death happened, the body should be buried right away, and that any kind of extended contact between the living and the dead was dangerous to the living and was also the wrong thing to do by the dead, that it hindered their journey up into the second level of the cosmos. So for Ishii, it's almost certain that he would not have wanted an autopsy to have been conducted.
Well, tell us how this comes out. I mean, did you end up finding the brain?
Well, what happened was that the brain, Ishii's brain, because the idea of studying brains was going out of fashion, was never studied. It stayed in a jar and then a tank with a bunch of other brains in a Smithsonian warehouse, ultimately in Maryland.
Is that what they call a think tank in Washington?
They may call it a think tank, indeed. They may indeed. These brains were floating in a stainless steel vat, and
yeah, that sounds like Brookings.
they were there through into the 1990s. They called it the wet collection. There's a special part of the Smithsonian warehouse where they keep all the pickled dolphins and the dog embryos and the brains. It's the stuff of a crazy science fiction movie or horror movie all in itself. And so what happened was I gave these letters that I had found showing that the brain had been sent to the Smithsonian to the Indian activists in Northern California, and they went to the press.
And what year is this?
We're talking 1999, 2000, about 15 years ago now. And so this became a mini little national story on All Things Considered and the New York Times and the Washington Post. And the Smithsonian was really quite embarrassed. They initiated right away kind of investigation to figure out how to return the brain. And ironically, they decided that the Maidu tribe, the tribe that had begun the whole crusade to bring Ishii's body back to Northern California, were not the closest living descendants of Ishii's Yahi. And instead, the Smithsonian chose two other tribes, the Pitt River Tribe and the Redding Rancheria. And to their credit, the Pitt River Tribe and the Redding Rancheria answered the challenge, and they picked a delegation of elders and spiritual people, about eight of them, and they flew out to Washington. This is right before 9/11. And they wrapped up Ishii's brain in a sacred deer skin, and they took it back as carry-on luggage back to California. And they drove up into the canyon of Deer Creek, 5 hours from San Francisco, and they held a ceremony, and they buried Ishii's brain and his ashes there in a spot that will remain secret forever.
And at this point, we're talking about roughly 2000, what did you think returning Ishii's brain would accomplish?
Well, you have to put this in the context of the so-called repatriation movement, which really gathers force in the 1990s. And this is the movement of Native Americans to demand back the skeletons and the sacred objects that have been dug up and stolen from them over the past 100 years.
So it's part of a larger reconciliation effort, if you will.
It's part of a larger effort at reconciliation. The U.S. government passes NAGPRA in 1990, which is a long name for a law that obligates museums to return human remains and sacred objects to their tribal descendants. So many Native Californians came to see Ishii as a symbol for all of the terrible things that were done to them. So doing the right thing by Ishii, reburying in his homeland, became for many Native Californians a way to try to reconcile themselves with a history in which they'd been very much mistreated and victimized, and which Ishii himself had been mistreated and victimized, his tribe wiped out, and his body desecrated after his death.
So once the dust settled, was there some sense of closure on the part of Native Americans here?
Well, I have a very personal perspective on this. I went in 2000, in September of 2000. It was a beautiful fall weekend up by Mount Lassen. And I went to the memorial ceremony, the public memorial ceremony that the Pitt River Tribe and the Redding Rancheria organized after they had done the secret burial of Ishii's remains. And so they held this ceremony out in the shadow of Mount Lassen with the beautiful California light in a meadow. And they invited everybody who wanted to come. So people flew out from the Smithsonian. People like me who had been involved came. Some of the Maidu came. Some people came up from whites and Indians from the Central Valley of California. And so we had this memorial ceremony there in the meadow to remember Ishii and to reflect upon his life and what meaning it might have for all of us. So this was, for me, a powerful ceremony, a powerful example of the effort at reconciliation, the effort to try to recognize the terrible things that have happened in the past, the terrible things that may still be happening in the world today, and to acknowledge those in together. But Native Californians and Native Americans in general are realistic. They don't imagine that a repatriation ceremony are going to fix the problems of poverty and alcoholism and marginalization. So I think for Native Americans, reconciliation, repatriation is just one piece of a much bigger puzzle that we together still haven't managed to solve.
Orrin Starn is an anthropologist at Duke University. He's the author of Ishii's Brain, In Search of America's Last Wild Indian.
It's time for another break, but stick around. When we get back, the surprising consequences of a gang truce on the mean streets of New York.
More backstory coming up in a minute.
This is Backstory. I'm Brian Bellow.
I'm Peter Onuf.
And I'm Ed Ayers. We're marking the 25th anniversary of the Berlin Wall's destruction with an hour exploring the American history of reconciliation.
By 1971, street gangs in New York were grabbing national headlines. The South Bronx was seen as the epicenter. The New York Times called it the capital of teenage gang power. There were at least 85 gangs there, the Times noted, with membership in the thousands. Violent turf battles between warlords routinely left young men dead in the streets. But at the same time, a story was unfolding that's not often told. Some of these feared gangs were attempting to settle their scores peacefully, and in the process, ended up changing a lot more than just the South Bronx. Our producer Andrew Parsons has the story.
It all started with a guy named Black Benji. His real name was Cornell Benjamin. He joined a gang called the Ghetto Brothers in April 1971.
I see him interacting with young people in the community, and I said, I like the way this guy conducts himself.
This is Benji Melendez, a different Benji, founder of the Ghetto Brothers.
We're going to drop the warlords and want to make this guy peace ambassador for the Ghetto Brothers.
Melendez had formed the gang a few years earlier, at the age of 13. By the early 70s, it was one of the biggest in the South Bronx, with membership stretching to all five boroughs. And it was then, in the height of the turf wars, that a Black Panther approached Melendez about using the Ghetto Brothers to help cut the violence. So Black Benji became the peace ambassador. One of his first assignments came that December.
So one day, a Ghetto Brothers scout runs into the Ghetto Brothers club and he says, Benji, there are three gangs coming down from Hunts Point. They're coming around your turf to get the Roman Kings. That was another club that was close to us. I looked at Black Benji and I said to him, Benji, go, take some Ghetto Brothers. He never came back.
Black Benji was reportedly beaten to death after trying to negotiate with those gangs. The killing of an unarmed Ghetto Brother pleading for peace incensed gangs across the borough. Many called for war.
I see all these gangs in front of the Ghetto Brothers Club. I mean, they were waiting for the biggest war. Yo, Benji, we heard what they done to your boy. Give us the okay and we'll take these guys.
Melendez didn't take the bait. Instead, after a visit with Black Benji's mother, the Ghetto Brothers announced that all the gangs in the South Bronx would hold a summit meeting to hash out the situation. On December 7th, 1971, more than 100 South Bronx gang leaders crowded into an auditorium of a local girls and boys club. Young men and women were frisked as they entered. Local reporters were there, and police snipers set up across the street in case anything got out of hand. They weren't the only ones concerned.
My eyes kept on roving around every member of that place. I kept on looking around, and I was walking in circles and looking, looking at their hands, looking at their legs, looking in, on the side of their jackets.
So what were you worried about?
That somebody there must have snuck in with a gun and do an assassination thing. Oh, yeah, these are the guys. Boom, shoot the guy right there, and then all hell would have broke loose.
The meeting was tense. It lasted for hours. But before long, the discussion had turned from who had wronged who to the root causes of gang activity. In a tape of the event, you can hear passionate testimonies about the lack of social services in the South Bronx, the crumbling infrastructure, the feeling of abandonment.
The whitey don't come down here, man, and live in the fucked up houses, man. The whitey don't come down here, man, and have no heat in the fucking winter time. You understand? We got to make it a better place to live. You understand? We do, Jack. So therefore, like...
Towards the end of the meeting, Melendez took advantage of the media attention and made a passionate and very public plea for peace.
The thing is, we're not a gang anymore. We're an organization. We want to help black and Puerto Ricans to live in a better environment. You don't want us to become a gang again, right?
Venting and mediation worked. The gangs agreed to a truce.
It helped to slow down a lot of beef.
This is African Bambaataa, one of the founders of hip-hop, in an interview with photographer Joe Conzo a few years back. He was at the peace meeting in 1971 and says the truce actually improved the situation in the Bronx. It wasn't easy. There were still small fights, but overall it held.
So it took a lot of stress and sticking together to keep all these different groups under that whole family of truce that the Gilla Brothers, Brother Benji, has put forward for everybody to come under.
A survey of teenage gang activity by the U.S. Justice Department confirms by the mid-1970s, violence in the South Bronx had declined. But the peace meeting had another legacy, says Julian Valoge, author of a graphic novel about this period. One of the treaty's rules required gangs to loosen restrictions on walking through others' territory.
For the first time, if you were a member of a gang, you could leave your territory, go to a territory of another gang, and not be beaten up, not have your colors taken away. You know, your world widened in a way.
One of those ways was music. You see, the Ghetto Brothers weren't just a gang. They were a band. We are glad to be here
today. The Ghetto Brothers were starting their own street parties. So they basically, I mean, Benji and his brothers loved music. They were playing music all the time, and they invited others to their street parties. They were making their music. People came, they danced, had a good time. So if you were like a Ghetto Brother, you could hang out with a girl from the Black Spades and not get beaten up for it. So that's really started it.
There had been street parties before the truce, but they were mostly attended by members of the same gangs throwing them. Suddenly, these street parties were allowing for a new kind of musical cross-pollination. In the lore of hip-hop, there's one infamous party that supposedly started it all. West of where the Ghetto Brothers ruled, DJ Kool Herc spun records at two turntables, back and forth, while kids from across the borough danced and took in a new blend of sounds. This was only a year and a half after the peace treaty.
Basically, the foundation of hip-hop was created thanks to this peace meeting. There was this exchange of ideas, exchange of creativity, and hip-hop. I mean, everything like developed during that time. Bambaataa in the East. Grandmaster Flash further north. They could travel there and see, you know, what was happening there. Broken glass everywhere. People pissing on the stage, you know, they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise. Got no money to provide, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room.
No one knows what would have happened if the Ghetto Brothers hadn't called that peace meeting in 1971. The 70s were still rough. These were the years that spawned the line, "The Bronx is burning." Then the crack epidemic of the 80s brought a new generation of violent gangs. But even then, you could hear the influence from the truce years. Yes, the lyrics echo the concerns of the gangs in Benji's meeting, but the tone reflects the result. It's fun. almost relieved.
Many people tell me this style is terrific. It is kind of different, but let's get specific. KRS-One specialized in music.
Andrew Parsons is one of our producers. You can read more about this story on our website, where we'll link to Julian Veloce's forthcoming graphic novel, Ghetto Brother, Warrior to Peacemaker.
So you think that hip-hop had its start out in Queensbridge?
If you pop that junk up... If you're just joining us, this is Backstory, and we're talking today about instances of reconciliation in American history. We're going to end with a story that really stretches the limits of reconciliation.
Hello, my name is Shigeko Sasamori. I was born in Hiroshima, Japan, and I was 13 years old when atomic bomb dropped in Hiroshima. And now I'm living in America many years.
Hi, my name is Clifton Truman Daniel. I'm Harry Truman's oldest grandson. I'm also the honorary chairman of the Harry S. Truman Library Institute in Independence, Missouri.
Shigeko?
Yes?
Tell me what you remember of the day that the bomb was dropped.
Yes, that was August 6, 1945. Such a hot day and a beautiful sunshine and blue sky. I heard the airplane. I look up the sky, was a silver, shining airplane, had a long white tail, and looks beautiful. So I told my classmate next to me, look up the airplane, and just I point out up the sky, I saw the white things coming down. Then almost same time, I had a very strong force knock me down. Then when I became conscious, then I looked around. I couldn't see anything. I couldn't hear nothing. Pitch black. Then pretty soon the blackness going away like a heavy fog going away. Then the first things I saw was the people moving. Some are under the houses or some on the street, and people hurt, everybody hurt, and ashes all over and skin. At that time I didn't think that was skin. Some are clothes hanging down, and everybody looked like a pink. And that moment, I couldn't figure out why they are like that. It looked like a horrible to explain.
Shigeko herself was horribly disfigured. One-fourth of the skin on her head, neck, and chest was severely burned. Like toast, she said. And her fingers were fused together. Her mother found her days later, lying in the darkness on the floor of a school auditorium where hundreds of victims were sheltered. At first, she didn't recognize her own daughter.
She had a candle, was saying my name, Shigeko, Shigeko, Shigeko. Then she heard me, very weak voice, saying, "Here I am." And then she looked down, and the Shigeko, and I say, "Here I am. Yes, I am." She could recognize me.
Truman's decision to drop the bombs remains controversial. Historians debate whether using the atomic bombs was really necessary to end the war. What we do know is that the nuclear arms race that began in the years following World War II would come to define global politics for generations. What memories do you have of your grandfather, President Harry S. Truman?
mostly he was grandpa.
Sure.
I didn't know that he'd been president until I was 6 years old, and I found out when I went to school one morning. One of the teachers in first grade asked me, the teacher said, "Wasn't your grandfather president of the United States?" And I said, "I don't know. It's news to me." You know, for the 15 years that I knew him, he was my grandfather.
Did you ever talk to him about the Second World War?
No. Nope. I learned about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki the same way you did, from my history books in class.
It would take many more years before Clifton truly connected to the events of August 1945. When his son was 10, he came home from school one day with a book about a different girl from Hiroshima named Sadako Sasaki. This was the story, you may have heard it, of a girl suffering from radiation poisoning. Sadako sets out to make 1,000 paper cranes, hoping, in accordance with Japanese lore, that she'll be granted a great wish. That wish was to be cured. But she died of leukemia at the age of 12, 9 years after the bombing.
That story, Sadako Sasaki's story, was the first time I had ever seen a personal story, a human story, from either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And it has a lot of power because you put a face on it. In my history book, it was numbers. You'll find a picture of the mushroom cloud. There will be casualty figures. It doesn't tell you in a lot of detail what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
One day, Clifton got a call from Japan. A man came on the line and told him that he was Sadako's older brother. A few years later, he invited Clifton to visit Japan.
My family and I attended the memorial ceremonies in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 2012, and we met with more than a dozen survivors. Each one of them asked only one thing, and that was to please keep telling their stories so that everybody on Earth would understand what it's like to live through a nuclear explosion in the hope that we do not do it again.
That was 2 years ago. Since then, Clifton has devoted himself to telling those stories. And in the process, he met and developed a friendship with Shigeko Sasamori, who now lives in L.A. They're both involved in a project that brings Hiroshima survivors to speak at American high schools and that advocates for nuclear disarmament.
The common enemy here, the enemy is atomic weapons, period.
Yes.
The indiscriminate nature, the radiation, just the power. And the weapons that we have today, each one of them is hundreds of times more powerful than the bomb that exploded over Hiroshima. You really begin to realize just what we could all visit on ourselves if we're not careful and if we don't get rid of them.
That's right. See, I think no matter what, atomic bomb is to me like a horrible poison, sort of a dynamite. Why the people holding dynamite right now? Everybody get the damage. Once war started, we are not survive. No one survived, that I feel. That's why I feel very urgent to people to open eye, open heart, to teach each other about war, what happens once war started. So people all over the world, the people together, country help this earth. That's what I wish.
That was Shigeko Sasamori, a survivor of America's nuclear strike on Hiroshima, along with her friend, Clifton Truman Daniel, Harry S. Truman's grandson. The advocacy project they both work on is called Hibakusha Stories. You can read more at hibakushastories.org.
That's going to do it for today. But we're eager to hear your thoughts about today's show. Our email address is backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at Backstory Radio. Whatever you do, don't be a stranger.
Today's episode of Backstory was produced by Tony Field, Nina Ernest, Andrew Parsons, Kelly Jones, and Robert Armengol. Our digital producer is Emily Gaddick, and Jamal Milner is our engineer. We had help from Coley Elhai. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham. Special thanks this week to Kathleen Sullivan and Bo Jacobs.
Major support for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional funding is provided by Weinstein Properties, by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment, and by History Channel, history made every day.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Peter Onuf is professor of history emeritus at UVA and senior research fellow at Monticello. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
Backstory is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.